everyone, and welcome to another edition of Responsive Design Weekly Podcast. My name is Justin Avery. I am your host and the curator of the Responsive Design Weekly newsletter. Strangely enough, a newsletter all about responsive design. This is episode number 47, so we're pushing up towards the number 50 mark, which is super awesome. This week, as you would have known from last week, we're finally back for 2016 after a lovely break over Christmas. Last week was an individual chat, so it was just me nabbering at your ears. And this week, I thought it'd be lovely, instead of hearing a droney Australian weird twangy accent, that we would invite someone with an accent that you are all more familiar with, someone from the States. But before I get to introducing our guest, I just wanted to point out that I have, and I do this all the time, right? So I have a sponsor, but I don't really have a sponsor. I just say what the guest is, and whatever they do is kind of sponsoring the show, because they're giving up their time to be on here and to chat about the web and to help educate. And in the spirit of education, this week's sponsor, the guest, comes from Aquant Gymnasium. These guys, well, actually, I won't go into it any further, but it's Gymnasium. So if you go to gymnasium.aquant.com, you can check it all out, but we'll talk about that a lot. So our special guest for this week is Mr. Jeremy Osborne. Welcome, Jeremy.
Welcome. How are you?
I am fantastic.
So just one point of correction there.
Got it wrong already.
Well, everybody does, because Aquant is the correct pronunciation, but the number of people who get that right are very few and far between, so don't worry about it, but it is Aquant.
Aquant, not Aquant.
So yes.
A-Q-U-E-N-T.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, don't go A-C-Q-U-E-N-T. So yes, no. Aquant. Right. Oh, I never knew that. The things you learn.
That's okay. You know, it's but Gymnasium you got correct, so that is good.
That would have been a problem if I got that wrong. But that's good. At least I got one part of it right. And the .com.
There you go. You got that right too. That's excellent.
2 out of 3 ain't bad, apparently. Should write a song. Mm-hmm. So welcome along. I suppose the best way to start, for those that haven't heard, I had heard of you before this, because I followed along on one of your courses for a little while. But for those that haven't heard of you, maybe just give a bit of background of who you are, where you're from, and sort of how you got into the industry.
Sure. So currently, my official title is Academic Director of Gymnasium. And what Gymnasium does is essentially distribute free courses on web design and development primarily, although we have some related topics as well, such as time management and UX and things like that. So that's what I've been doing for the last 2.5-3 years. And in general, though, I've been in the field of web design since probably close to the beginning. So I was building websites back in 1997, 98, and I started off kind of, you know, at that point, everyone learned how to do it essentially on their own, or a little help from other folks who were publishing blogs and books, things like that. But then I was a designer at a number of startups during the initial dot-com boom at the turn of the century. I think we can say that now. and so I was doing kind of your garden variety, you know, HTML, slicing up graphics in Photoshop. I guess I was a webmaster.
Nice. that's bringing back one of the terms.
Yeah. And so I did that at a number of startups. And then when the whole crash happened, and for those of you youngins out there who don't remember, like, that did happen. There was a time when the web was kind of felt like it was on the rocks a little bit. But at that point, I did a combination of things. I started doing some freelancing, and I decided I really wasn't cut out for that. And I turned to doing training and teaching. And so I did that for a number of years. And then around 2005 or so, I was given the keys to an interactive and graphic design program at a university here in the States called Boston University. And that was kind of a fun period of my life. Basically, it was a 9-month certificate program that featured graphic design in the first half and web design in the second half. And the owners of this extension program basically said, hey, we need someone to do this. Are you interested? And I jumped at the chance. So prior to that, I had done a lot of consulting with large companies that most people have heard of. And I just did training on subjects like Photoshop and Dreamweaver and InDesign and kind of all sorts of stuff. But my true love really has always been the web. And so that certificate program was a lot of fun, extremely exhausting. So I lasted about 2 or 3 years. And ever since then, I've kind of been doing a combination of writing. So I've written a couple books on web design. So HTML5 Digital Classroom is the last book I published. And that at this point, that's about 4 or 5 years ago. But I did some books on Dreamweaver also back in the day.
Nice.
And yeah, and I could talk about that because that was an interesting experience. But for the most part, I've been involved with, you know, digital education. So teaching people how to make websites. And at this point, I continue to dabble in code, and I never stray too far from it. But I spend a lot of time producing courses and working with other instructors who bring a lot to the conversation as well. And so that's kind of me in a nutshell. I should also mention originally, you know, when I learned how to do this stuff, as I mentioned before, there was really no place to do it. My original background was actually in film and video. So I went to film school many, many years ago. This was totally pre-digital. So this was like analog. So I bring all these things, I think, to what I do now, which is the ability to survey the field of digital design and try to figure out, like, you know, what's cool, what's happening, what's coming up, how can I best teach people how to get into the field.
Oh, that sounds very cool. As a really weird aside, when you were doing your film school and the analog stuff, so were you working on like Bolex cameras?
We did that. So it was a combination of film and video. So I was cutting 16mm film, you know, with tape and splices and so forth. And on the video side of thing, we were using, what I guess we now call linear editing, which no one does anymore, because we all do nonlinear editing, which is digital. But back then it was, you know, two decks side by side, and you know, you press play on one and record on the other, and that's how you made your video.
I still think it's crazy how we still call it like you cut something up.
Yeah,
but like literally you used to cut something up.
That's right. And you know, the funny thing about that was that I was actually not particularly good at that. And what I mean by that is I grew up, I guess I'm kind of the digital age. You know, I grew up right when things like the Mac were coming into existence. And so, you know, I learned how to write papers, you know, on a Mac, copying and pasting. And so I think my brain was always kind of digital. And so when I went into film and video, it was almost like, oh, God, this doesn't really feel right. And then years later, when digital editing became a thing, I was like, oh, yeah, this is really what I was looking for back then, which is kind of, you know, an interesting aside by itself, perhaps.
Yeah. I always love going back into trying to dig up and do some editing on some old movies and stuff when I don't have any time anymore. But I used to enjoy it. I used to like trying to do surf editing and stuff. But I think it's just going to the beach a lot to do the filming part of it.
Nice.
So you taught a little bit between sort of 2000 and 2005, and it was kind of like an in-person course, I'm guessing,
right? Yeah.
But it was about digital stuff.
Yep.
And between 2000 and 2005, I imagine a ton of stuff changed. But between 2005 and 2016 and what you're doing now, like, how has that education transformation been?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, there's kind of two threads that are going on there. So, you know, so one is just, you know, teaching, you know, software or, you know, even web design by itself has changed a lot. And first of all, you know, the community and the knowledge base was much smaller back in 2005. So in a sense, things kind of were much simpler in some sense. So, you know, we had things like HTML, and of course, you know, when CSS came out, that was this radical this radical departure in a way. And what's, you know, what's easy to forget was there was a lot of resistance at the time. So the training company where I worked, I was kind of like the web guy in the training company. And a lot of people were just kind of using the tools that they had learned, which in that case was usually Dreamweaver or GoLive was the other one. I don't even know how many people remember GoLive, but
I don't remember that. I do remember the first bit of software I bought was FrontPage 2000.
Oh boy, that's. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your loss. but yeah, GoLive was Adobe's offering, and you know the thing was those programs really tried to avoid the fact that you're writing in code, and we know that that just doesn't work. So when I was starting the program, the web program in 2005, you know, I kind of made at the time what felt like a bold leap for an educational institution, which was like, hey, we're going to teach hand coding. You know, we're not going to teach Dreamweaver. We're not going to show you, you know, we're going to dig right into the hand coding. And I was just talking about this with someone the other day. You know, at the time, it really felt like a risk to me, because what I didn't want was students graduating from the program, you know, had paid all this money, and then they get into the workforce and their skills were like so cutting edge that people were like, whoa, you know, what's this? You don't know how to use Dreamweaver? and, you know, of course, it turned out the bet paid off. And of course, when people graduated, employers were loving the fact that they knew how to hand code. But at the time, there was a lot of resistance, and of course, and so now, you know, that battle has been won for a long time, and everyone acknowledges, like, yeah, we need people who are flexible, who know how to code HTML, CSS, and hopefully some JavaScript by hand. And so, when it comes to teaching that, though, that's where it gets interesting. Again, on one hand, it was very easy to teach people how to build a website in 2005. And trying to do the same thing now requires a lot more thought. It's much more complicated. There's a lot of other stuff that you have to pay attention to.
There's a lot of stuff just to get going.
Yeah.
I find sometimes we've just overcomplicated mm-hmm. the getting started bit. But
yeah, and it's... You know, and so it's tricky. We're at a very interesting stage in both, you know, education, but also just the web development, you know, the field of the web. It's very easy to forget how intimidating and how hard just something like CSS is. You know, CSS is kind of an awkward language on some respects. It keeps on getting better and better, which is great, but there are still some very basic concepts that, you know, you got to make sure you know before you move to the next stage. So, you know, it's an interesting time right now.
is there anything at the moment that, so like going from teaching people in classrooms to, mm-hmm. to predominantly, and we'll talk more about, what's on Gymnasium and how that works, yep. but, from being face to face with people and going to mainly these days, we are like very much just an online learning. Have we lost anything between the two? And are we, if we have, are we bridging the gaps in right. any way?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're still very much apples and oranges, and I think that people are trying to figure out the best model. So, you know, the in-person, well, let me try to put it in perspective this way. I sat down a couple of years ago trying to figure out roughly how many people I had influenced or taught in some way. So whether it be, you know, face-to-face in a classroom or in a workshop or a seminar or online or whatever. And it was actually very hard to do because I've been teaching for over, you know, 10, 15 years. And so I kind of came up with this number of 3,000 people. I figured, you know, I think that may be, you know, again, with the widest definition of teaching possible. Maybe that's somebody who just listened to something I did for 20 minutes or half an hour. But hopefully I passed along something. So, okay, well, yeah, so 3,000. I feel like, okay, that's still, okay, that's pretty good. And then, you know, my responsive web design class, which we put online, you know, 2.5, 3 years ago, I don't know the exact numbers, but at one point we were up at upwards of 12,000 students. And I thought, God, that's just amazing. You know, they're now clearly not every one of those 12,000 are learning the same way that they would in the classroom. Maybe someone's just dipping in for half an hour or so, but still that number is four times the size of, you know, the total number of people I've taught over a period of 10 years. So, but they are very different. Doing, you know, learning how to, you know, make a responsive site or just any site, when you're doing it in person, you have the freedom to make a lot of mistakes and the teacher sitting next to you and saying like, oh, you forgot the semicolon here, you know, and you know, the difference obviously online is you don't have that immediate support.
Yeah.
And so that changes the way you teach, hopefully. You can't just do it as if you can't just turn on a camera and record the same lecture that you would do in a classroom. That's just not going to work. Unfortunately, that's what a lot of people do. You know, we try to stay away from that style because the truth is it's just different. You have to try to anticipate the problems that people are going to run into. And it really helps if you've done that in person before.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
so how do you then translate that to an online thing? Like, is there one thing that you do, especially like perfect example, like forgetting semicolons, forgetting a brace, they are great. Like you churn for hours looking at that stuff before you realize.
Exactly. Yeah. So the best answer is just experience. And so that's why, you know, I happen to have the benefit of having taught this, you know, again, many, many times to the point where I have kind of an internal dialogue with myself and I anticipate like, oh, this is, you know, at this point, this is where someone can really screw up because I've seen it happen dozens of times before. And so in a video, you're going to try to, you know, jump ahead and say, you know, be really careful about this part.
Right. Yeah. Really, you know, articulate really, it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a perfect example are, you know, just plain old CSS media queries, right? So the fact that you're putting your nested styles, you know, your curly braces inside of another CSS statement, you know, the first time you encounter that, it feels really weird, right? You're like, wait. I thought I knew CSS, but now you're putting like another rule inside of a rule. Like that's crazy. Now you quickly get used to that. But what's important to remember is like the first time somebody encounters that, like it's a little mind boggling. And so the only way you would know that is if you've done it before and you've run into those questions.
Well, that's good experience.
Yeah.
There are no easy answers. Sorry, folks. Mm-hmm. So speaking of the gymnasium course, the RWD course, can you talk about the sort of the process you went through to put that together and some of the challenges that you were looking to solve?
Sure. So one of the things that we're trying to do with gymnasium, and I should point out that, you know, we have to make, so actually this kind of goes back to your other question too. There is a difference between teaching people who are absolute beginners versus folks who have had some experience. And so one of the shortcuts we kind of take is we took a stance that, you know, we're not trying to do what folks like lynda.com or Treehouse are doing in the sense of, like, we're not necessarily addressing absolute beginners. So people who have never had experience with coding or HTML before. And we figure, you know, there are other people who are doing that, and we're not going to try to compete with it. So in the case of the responsive web design course, you know, there are some prerequisites there that I started off with. And the assumption there is, like, you know, people have had some experience with HTML and CSS. They understand the basic flow. They know the difference between, you know, block and inline. And, you know, so we don't have to totally go over all that. We can assume that people have had a couple years of experience. And we try to make that clear up front. Having said that, you know, there's still going to be a lot of stuff that's new to many people. And so, you know, the process was essentially, let's get people up and running as soon as possible. You know, give them some files, show them what to do, give them some direction so that they can experiment and see what happens when, you know, they move the browser window back and forth and the content flows. And so the general idea was, you know, to give people enough direction so they can follow along. And that's really the most important thing when it comes to this sort of teaching is you have to keep everything interactive. You have to imagine that you're, you know, sitting next to somebody, looking over their shoulder, and you're kind of showing them to a certain degree where to click or what to do. But at the same time, you have to be a little careful, and you know, you can't be too prescriptive, because then it gets very boring. It's like just like a recipe. So, right. So it's kind of like this fine-tuned balance between, like, here's what I want you to do, and then now go ahead and do it. So in general, you know, the course, and so the other kind of twist to this is the assignments there are for people to build a responsive portfolio. So the idea there is by the end of the course, you will have something that advertises who you are, what your experience is, and that it can be like your calling card, right? You can go ahead and you can expand it as much as you want, but it gives people that motivation, because, of course, that is the big killer when it comes to online classes, is motivation. If you, again, this goes back to your other question too. If you don't have somebody kind of nagging you to finish, right? Like, hey, you know, you're almost there. Like, keep going. You're like, you're so close. I know it's frustrating. The problem with online education is that, you know, when a student gets frustrated, there's a high percentage that they're going to leave and they might never come back, right? there's nobody paying attention. And the fact that all our courses are free also adds to that, right? There's absolutely nothing.
Yeah, there's no monetary penalty for them for not completing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I want to cover off some of the free thing as well. But I do like that. Like, I do like Treehouse, but I often struggle because it's the I struggle with any online learning thing where it's just learning for the sake of learning. Mm-hmm. Whereas you don't, if you can create something, the best time to learn is when you have a problem and you solve it.
Exactly.
And you have something to show for it at the end, because you will remember the things that you did. It wasn't. And so I love the idea of having this portfolio at the end. I think that's quite cool. And so when you were doing that course, what was your what was your biggest sticking point? Like the thing that you found most difficult to teach someone about responsive design? Like, was it a technique, a technical thing, a concept?
Yeah, probably the area that was the hardest was, well, let's just say it was the hardest to teach was the responsive typography. And the reason for that is typography is such a complex subject to begin with, and I had limited time. And so, you know, most of these individual lessons were, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour. And responsive typography is very tricky in some sense. You know, it might work, you know, you might get everything figured out correctly in your, you know, mobile view, right? Your single column view, and it feels pretty easy. But then you have all these choices you have to make as soon as you're dealing with larger screens, right? So all that stuff like line length, you know, how much content can you put on a page before it starts getting unreadable? Mm-hmm. You know, the distance between the lines, all that stuff. Again, it's like a moving target, right? It's like once you nail it in the single column, you've got a different problem once you move up in screen width, right? And there's just so much to it. And so I think that was a little tricky to do. And it was ambitious in the sense that I was trying to teach, you know, also, I would say more of the stylistic or the aesthetic aspects of type. So again, you know, choosing the right web font, you know, choosing the right font for your page is kind of like the basis of everything, right? And so that's an important step. You don't want to just kind of randomly choose the first thing and then assume that it's going to work if you change the font. It's like, no, you know, that starting font is really important to get right. Mm. So that was kind of tricky to do. And yeah, I think it worked out, but that was definitely a hard one to write.
Yeah, I've had Jordan Moore on the podcast and in the interview series before as well, and he's just is all about type, and he always does the same thing. And I think there was I can't remember who wrote it. Maybe it was Trent Walton, perhaps, but it was like the web, or maybe it was Information Architects. But the web is 95% typography.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, that it's kind of crucial to get that down. And that's still, and it's also one of the, and it's one of the areas too, where you still see, I've always considered type is, that's the place where you can't hide, right? And the example I always used to use, you know, came down to like a resume, right? So when you submit a paper resume, when you're writing a resume in Microsoft Word, for example, you know, there's a default font that you get. And it's usually, you know, it used to be Times New Roman, and I guess now it's Calibri on Microsoft Word, or at least it was a couple years ago. And so the question is, are you going to change that font? And most people are going to say, like, yeah, of course, you know. And then you ask, well, why? Why are you going to change that font? And the responses might be, well, you know, because it's the default font. I'm like, okay, so that's a good point. You know, why else? Well, because you know, I like this other font better. And once you get into that discussion, that becomes this discussion of, you know, that typography has meaning, and it carries. Character and personality, and it says something about the content. And once you accept that argument, you realize, yeah, you know, well, where do we go next? So what I often see is students who are kind of, you know, they don't really know why they're choosing a font. They think it looks cool, It's kind of funky, right? It's distinctive. And sometimes they go way too far with that, right? and that's a big issue. It's like, well, you can definitely go too far with that personality character thing too. So yeah, it's crucial though. That's what makes or breaks, you know, a good designer, you know, and a great designer. It's like a great designer will always have command of their typography.
And so you've also, like, speaking of like getting started with like, mm-hmm. a resume and getting started with a type as well, you mm-hmm. do have a very specific look and type across the sites that you have now. Mm-hmm. I want to say thank you to yourself and to Aquent, right? Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
For like a few years ago, I think you sponsored the newsletter, which is always a big help, and we featured the responsive design course, and I think quite a few people mm-hmm. signed up and did it really easy because it's free. But I remember looking at the site, and it wasn't as visually stimulating as it is now.
Yep.
So it looks like you guys have recently gone through at least two new redesigns, one for the gymnasium Aquent and the other one, which is the Vitamin Talent or the Vitamin T site.
Yeah. So yeah, let me try to separate some of that stuff. So yeah, so there's kind of two components. So Aquent, as I mentioned before, is kind of the parent company of gymnasium. So they pay the bills and there's a whole rationale there for making gymnasium a thing, and we can talk about that later, I guess. You know, Vitamin T is kind of like the sister company of Aquent, and so they're both staffing companies, but they're for different audiences. And gymnasium itself has gone through a big change. I'm going to say 4 or 5 months ago, we launched on the OpenEdX platform. And so OpenEdX is you might have heard of edX before. So edX is kind of a collaboration between Harvard and MIT, and their goal is to provide free education, you know, to hundreds of millions of people. And one of the things, so they're one of the first MOOCs, a massive open online course is kind of the category of you know, online school, I guess you could put edX in. It shares space with Udacity and Coursera. Those are some of the other big ones, and gymnasium as well. So we consider ourselves in that category. So OpenEdX is basically a platform. It's kind of a learning and management system. So it combines aspects of a content management system like, you know, Drupal or WordPress, but it's specifically geared towards education. So there are some components in there for things like grading and student progress and things of that nature. We're not an official institution, so in some ways we can just kind of make it do whatever we want. And we spent an awful lot of time customizing the default the default theme, so to speak. And we've got someone on our team whose name is Mike Bufulco, and he's kind of our director of technology. And he was kind of the leading force between taking the existing styles and basically skinning them, you know, customizing them with our theme. And it was a lot of work. It was an awful lot of work.
Did you start with looking at the, because this is a common problem that people have. They get given a default. So whether I know a lot of people work in corporates that might have SharePoint, right? And they get given this SharePoint thing. But everyone wants to design their own thing and then make that how it looks. So did you start with a design? How did you start?
So we did have luck, you know, we had, so our version 1.0 of the site had been kind of designed in-house as well, and then built by another web development firm. And so we kind of had the look and feel that we wanted. So again, the typography was there, you know, using primarily Brand and Grotesque is the core typeface that we use. And we had the color theme, you know, so the black, the white, the orange. And then, so we were able to build upon the version 1.0 website. But, the real issue was some of the limitations that the theming structure for OpenEdX was, to put it lightly, complicated. It's kind of, I'm not the super tech person here, so I'm probably going to get some of this wrong, but it's using a combination, you know, of Python and MongoDB as a database, and obviously HTML and CSS. But it's not like WordPress. You know, you're not kind of going in with PHP and just making a few changes. Like you have to dig deep into the code, and the code is relatively new, and it was changing all the time. So we actually did a presentation on this, which I should probably, I can find the URL for that at some point if people are interested, where we discussed all the headaches and the challenges that we had to go through, because it was really a moving target. We've got a small team of about 3 or 4 people. So we've got a designer on our team. His name is Justin Gagne, and he did a lot of the designs. We were coding in the browser. Andrew Miller is our program director, and he was kind of overseeing the whole process. And of course, Mike was doing the heavy lifting. You know, the funny thing is, we're all designers, or we tend to be closer to the design side of things, with the possible exception of Mike. But he had a UX background as well. So we had these high standards. We didn't want to put something out that we weren't proud of. And that also resulted in a lot of, you know, hand-wringing over the details and, you know, like, what does this look like? You know, is this hairline too thin? What about this color gray? So, you know, so designers are like kind of the worst, you know, people to be clients for. You know, it's like, again, designing your own website is like one of the hardest things in the world to do, because you're just constantly self-criticizing yourself. So it was a little bit like that, but in the end, we pulled something together that is pretty unique. When the last I looked, or when we went to this OpenEdX conference, there were about 400 or 500 sites around the world that had kind of customized the OpenEdX theme, you know, to the degree that we did. And so it's like, I feel like we were on the bleeding edge a little bit, trying to figure out how to make this work. Yeah, yeah.
It does look really good, actually. It looks really nice. One thing I noticed, too, is I know that the Vitamin T is a different beast, and it runs probably not on the OpenEdX platform. But one thing I found interesting is that on Gymnasium, you have a course called Coding for Designers. No, not that one, but I was looking at, where is it? It was Grid Layout in Bootstrap 3.
Oh, yeah, that was one of mine. One of my gym shorts.
Yep. So, yeah, I like that. I like the title. So for any short course on Gymnasium, they call them gym shorts. Very good. So you've got Grid Layout in Bootstrap 3. Bootstrap's great. But then on the Vitamin T, it's built on Foundation.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, these are apples and oranges. OpenEdX uses Bootstrap. And because that comes along for the ride, we just had to run with it. And so these are really two separate development platforms. We basically had no choice when it came to the Gymnasium layout. So the OpenEdX system uses Bootstrap. We had to use Bootstrap, or try to
rebuild everything.
From the ground. Yeah. So there was. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's a testament to what you can do. Like both of them, neither of them look like traditional bootstrap / foundation sites. They both look very similar in look and feel and branding, yet they are from a different framework anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of, you know, what, I mean, part of the mission there is, you know, both Aquent and Vitamin T serve designers, right? So they're staffing companies that give designers jobs. And so having said that, you know, so when your clients or the people who you're targeting are designers themselves, you know, you need to walk the walk, right? You need to have something that that they can respect and that fits, you know, their idea of, you know, what they're looking for in a company that might be representing them. So having high standards for design is something that, you know, is very important.
Now, I hadn't thought of this before, but I'm sure there's plenty of listeners out there that are designers or web mm-hmm. developers that may be looking for new jobs. The Vitamin T looks very focused on if I was looking to hire someone, but is it easy to get on there as an employee, a possible employee, like a freelancer mm-hmm. or something?
Yeah, I mean, this is where danger, you know, we're reaching dangerous territory in the sense that I am not as familiar with that side of the business, but I can definitely tell you that for the most part, you know, Vitamin T is looking for people who are going to be working in like in the smaller agency situation.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, small companies maybe 10, 20 employees. The Aquent business is really geared at Fortune 500. So there's kind of like, you know, different people want to work in different situations, right? And so for the most part, it's kind of like, yeah, if you want to work like in a more, you know, like in a funkier setting and, you know, kind of work with people who, you know, share your style, your viewpoint, whatever. You know, so that's kind of what Vitamin T is about. If you're very comfortable in the corporate setting and, you know, you like a bigger paycheck maybe, then that's kind of what Aquent does. And of course, you know, that's what the Fortune 500 is all about, right?
That's so true.
So, yeah.
Oh, nice. I must say, I do love the, recently, who was it? Environments for Humans ran their SVG summit the mm-hmm. other week, and I very lucky managed to grab a ticket to that. And there was some really good stuff on SVG. Well, it was all about SVG, but SVG yep. animations with Sarah Drasner, and I yep. really love. So the vitamintalent.com site has got some really cool SVG animations as you sort of scroll down the page as well.
Yeah, that's good. I'll let so. I work with one of the designers involved with that, or I should say developers, and his name is Roman. Roman, this is a shout out to you because I was just talking to him the other day. So he's responsible for a lot of that stuff. And I know that, again, it's part of like walking the walk. It's about, you know, especially when it comes to like graphics, like SVGs is like, that's where it's at, man. You know, it's like you got to, everyone needs to get on board with that. And people are, so.
Yeah, well, if we're building these multi-device websites, we've got to push the multi-device vector graphics. You only make one of them, and they'll scale anywhere.
Yep.
I suppose outside of, like, for web projects these days, like, how did you decide what you were going to support? So a lot of the arguments are around like, oh, I don't want to use Flexbox because it's only supported with this and I can't use that. And how mm-hmm. have you seen that grow?
Yeah, well, that's a huge challenge. And so, you know, obviously the initial answer is always, well, you know, it depends, which, you know, what are you going to support? Your client might have a lot to say when it comes to that. But for the most part, you know, I relied heavily on just trying to understand the level of support, you know. And so, of course, you know, everyone should have, you know, caniuse.com, like, you know, on the short list of their bookmarks to find out what the level of support is. And so those were some challenges, and those were kind of probably the most vexing problems that I faced. You know, so again, when I was mentioning responsive typography, at the time of the, you know, when I made the course, which is 3 years ago, roughly, you know, I had to decide, like, should I include, you know, REMS, you know, should we go there, or should I just stick with M? And at the time, it was like right on the edge. It was right on the border. Like, you know, the level of support was, you know, at that point where I could have done it. But I said, you know, I'm not going to, because honestly, M's can be complicated enough. And so to add this other angle, but if I was to do the course again, like today, then, you know, REMS would obviously be in there. So I think, like everything else, it's kind of a matter of just paying attention to the browser support and, you know, trying to figure out, at the very least, you can kind of mention other places to look. And I try to do that as well. You know, another good example, of course, is obviously responsive images. So, you know, a few years ago, the picture element and all that responsive goodness that is now starting to make its way into browsers, you know, was just a pie, you know, it was just, you know,
yeah,
hey, that's, yeah, it's going to be great. You know, we can use picture fill, and, you know, I've relied heavily on picture fill at the time, and many people still do. And so a lot of it is just, again, this is why web development these days is increasingly more complicated. It's like, can one person pay, you know, understand everything that's happening? And can they stay on top of everything that's happening? And the answer is no, you can't. It's not humanly possible.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I took a note when you were talking about stuff. You were talking about, like, being a webmaster at the beginning. And there was a couple of names that we had for people who looked after websites. So back then, and had Dreamweaver. That was by Macromedia before Adobe took over and stuff. But now there's very, very specialized roles. Like, you're a front-end developer, or you, like, specialize in HTML. Like, who would have thought? As an academic director and someone who sort of is in charge of putting a sort of a curriculum of free available courses to people, is there anything that you think is a catch-all or a must-do if someone wants to work online these days, or, like, building websites, I suppose?
So do you mean, like, in sense of, like, the skills that they need, or just kind of...
Yeah, like, because it is so very now, like, back in the day, we were webmasters because we knew how to do the web. And now the web is such a big thing that you can't know everything. But surely there's a few fundamentals that you would recommend making sure that you base yourself with some foundations.
Sure. So again, well, I mean, I think that the, you know, it almost feels self-evident, because this goes back to the whole responsive thing, but the idea of a mobile first philosophy, so that, again, so here's a common issue that I run into all the time. And this is particularly true. And so again, here's where there's an interesting catch-22 that, you have a group of people who are designers who kind of grew up in the pre-responsive world. And I actually equate this with the old days of when CSS layout versus table layout was a thing. And there was kind of like this argument still. There were like these holdouts, people who are like, yeah, I'm never going to stop designing with tables. That's the only way to do it, right? And you know, so this was like this major source of debate and conflict. And, of course, you know, CSS layout obviously won. Now, I relate that to kind of responsive versus non-responsive. So in other words, you've got a group of folks who are using older techniques, or I should say, you know, like non-responsive fixed width techniques. They understand they need to make things responsive, but you know, maybe they don't want to. Maybe they're going to go with like the M dot site, or maybe they're going to go halfway and they're going to kind of take their desktop site and kind of retrofit it to semi kind of responsive. And so it kind of comes back to, well, if you're going to take this leap, then, which is not a huge leap, by the way, but it's like, if you're going to do it, then you got to remember a few things. And so a classic example, you know, a mistake that I see, especially people who have prior experience, is, you know, they'll kind of build their mobile first site. So kind of single column, they'll get that nailed. And then, you know, and they'll add like a couple breakpoints, and then they'll kind of go back into the desktop view. And then they kind of forget all about the mobile view. You know, they kind of like, they're like, well, I think I figured that all out. And maybe not realizing that it continues to be like a push and pull. There's a conversation that you have to start with yourself when you make changes in the desktop, and then you may have to see how that reflects in the mobile. And, you know, so it's not like you just finish the mobile view and then, you know, like, hey, you're done. And now I'm going to go to this one and this one. It's one. And again, it's Jeremy Keith, as we know, brilliantly said, you know, that the web is a continuum, right? And so responsive design is similar to that. It's like you can't, you know, the danger is trying to separate, you know, the mobile versus tablet versus desktop view. And well, no, you know, the truth is it's just they're all important, and they all kind of talk to each other and inform each other in a way. So I think that's something that is really important. And in a way, I think it might be easier for kind of like the new crop of designers and developers. I would, you know, if I was teaching in a classroom again, which I haven't done for a couple of years, but if I was doing it, you know, I would just start people. I would start people, you know, designing their single column, like mobile view, right?
Yeah.
And then build out, which again, it seems, you know, if you pay attention to responsive web design at this point, we all know that that's kind of what you should do. But to actually have people learning the web for the first time and coding their pages for mobile, because that is becoming the primary or, you know, a central way of looking at the web, that's a radical difference. and it's exciting. You know, on the other hand, what we also see now is people who swing way too far in the other way. I'm sure you've kind of, you know, run into this or posted some articles about this. And that's, you know, people who are so focused on the mobile view that they kind of oversimplify
the desktop. Right?
Yeah. So it's like all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute now. The desktop does have some unique characteristics. We shouldn't be treating the desktop like it's a touchscreen either, right?
Yeah. Or like it's only, fits in the palm of your hand kind of thing.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, it is such a tough balance to align the two. And I see loads of examples of that with I've seen sites that have come out of a place where I work where they have there's sites all over the place now where they have the mobile hamburger menu regardless.
Yep.
Doesn't matter what size the screen is, it's just tucked in behind there. And
yep.
Whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing, hopefully you've done some kind of user testing and
exactly.
Worked it through with some people to come up with, yes, this is actually a logical mm-hmm. approach to the design in that particular thing for your own clients. Like you said, I think one of the other answers you said, it really depends.
Exactly. Well, that's almost becoming So that's going to be the new one of the new cliches, because
it's such a go-to answer.
Oh yeah, it depends. But it's, you know, it's true. It's there. And I think this is coming back to just the complexity these days and the difficulty, you know, the challenge that people who want to start building sites are going to have. It's like there's so much to learn and there's so many variables. And so it's important, you know, I think probably some of the biggest lessons that I've learned over the years don't really come down to technical, right? They come down to almost a state of mind or what you need to be thinking about. And for example, one of those is never assume that your current project has anything to do with your last one.
Yeah.
Right? It's like every project is different, but at the same time, it is such a common mistake. And I think everyone, you know, I still do it myself. It's like, you know, you just learned something, you just figured something out on a project, and then you get another one and it, on the surface, it looks and sounds very similar. So you want to use the same solutions. Turns out, you know, they might not be correct. You know, those might not be the right solutions. You're going to have to figure it out yet again. And that's what makes this industry so exciting on one hand, right? That's people who are drawn to this and people who excel love learning, right? They love the change. They love the fact that they have to constantly learn new stuff. At the same time, it can get overwhelming. It can be totally exhausting to have to, like, again, I'm sure you run into this all the time as you're putting together like your newsletter, just like, wow, like here's all this new stuff. You know, which of it is going to stand the test of time, and which of those things are going to maybe die out because they're faddy or they don't really solve the problem, but they sound cool.
I did think about this at the very beginning to ask you. I know we're running out of time, and thank you very much for taking so much time to have this chat. But so the question I thought of earlier, so yeah, two more questions. One was from a previous guest or as part of an interview series. Each week or each podcast, when I have a guest, I ask a question of a previous guest, and then I also ask you to ask a question of the next guest. So while I ask this the final question, you can have it can mull in your mind about what you might ask. But again, as sort of like an academic director, I remember when I was I went to university for a very brief time, and I attended a class, and at the end of one of the classes, I sort of went up to the lecturer and pulled him aside, and I said, look, thank you for, it was an IT class, and we were talking about web in some way, shape, or form. And I pulled him aside and I said, look, I hate to pull you up on something, but I'm doing this at work, and you're teaching something differently. Am I doing it wrong? And he said, no, absolutely not. You're doing it right. It's just that this is the syllabus I need to test. This is what you're going to be examined on. So this is what I'm teaching you. And stupid 19-year-old me just went, well, what's the point in going to university? And I bailed. But now the web moves even faster. So this is like 1999, 2000. It moves even faster. So as an academic director and person in charge of gymnasium and producing these courses, how do you guys go about deciding, right, this is just fluff and this is a fad, or this is a real thing, or this is a fad but it teaches general principles? Like, do you have like a vetting process?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. There's a combination of things that we do. So one of it is just kind of based on the informal network of people that I know in the industry. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for just experience. But there's also some analytical data that we can use. And this is where one of the benefits of having kind of a larger organization that has, you know, big clients who are doing web stuff. So when we choose our courses, we don't do it randomly. We kind of look and we find out, you know, what are companies looking for? Like, what skills do they need? What are they seeing in their departments that, you know, isn't working? You know, is it prototyping? Do people need to figure out how to do responsive prototyping? You know, so we kind of go straight to the source. We don't just guess. So that, I think that's kind of part of it. And then it goes back to the other piece, and it's just finding people who we trust and people who have good reputations. The last two courses that we did or released, one of them is called Writing for Web and Mobile. Mm-hmm. And the instructor for that is Stephanie Hay, who at the time when we were recording, she was kind of a independent consultant and lecturer, and now she's the director of content strategy for Capital One. And so it's like, okay, you know, that's a good, you know, that's kind of what we're looking for. We're looking for people who represent, you know, the forward thinking section of the industry. You know, the other course that we just released is called Information Design and Data Visualization. So that's really all about, you know, what tools do you need for you know, to create graphics, infographics, charts, graphs, and all that. And the instructor there is Graham Roberts, who is one of the senior interactive editors. Probably got that title wrong. But anyway, he's one of the folks who do this for the New York Times. And so it's like, you know, that's one of our goals. We find people who are doing this work for real, and we bring them on as instructors.
Well, that's probably the best way, right?
To teach
what's actually important.
Yep, and you know, it's hopefully again, there's a thread that goes through a lot of web conferences. I think this is Brad Frost who said this at a conference where basically it's like, you know, none of us really know what we're doing up front. It's just like we're giving it our best shot and things seem to work out. But honestly, you know, in the end, we're just giving it the best shot we can.
That sounds very, very much like Brad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. Yeah, a very humble man for a very intelligent little soul. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is almost about all time we have. So I do have one more question, which is the one from before. But before I do answer that, because I always ask it and then forget to ask the guest their question. So for 2016, I'm going to try and ask it first. Do you have a question for the next guest?
Okay. I'm going to make this one probably harder than the one I'm going to get, but maybe not. Let's see. Let's try this one. What is something you believe that almost nobody agrees with you on?
Oh, that is good.
Right? I'm sorry. Whoever has to answer that, I apologize in advance.
That is really good. I should just re-ask you that question. But
No.
It's too hard. So this one is from Dave Rupert. So he says, he sets the scene as well, which is lovely. You're wandering on a path in a thick meadow and you meet a necromancer in dark robes who grants you the power to resurrect one website. What website do you summon from the dead pool and why?
Okay. Does it have to be related to necromancers? I don't think so, right? It doesn't have to have a necromancer theme.
Whatever floats your boat.
let's see. Well, I think I'm going to have to go with the old school nostalgia. And I would love to resurrect suck.com.
Suck.com.
S-U-C-K. This is for those who don't know. And this will.
I'm not even going to type this into my Google.
You can. You can. This was. It sounds like something that's not ready for prime time. But in fact,
it is actually. It's safe for work. Safe for work.
It is, and it was. So this was kind of one of the. This is one of the websites that kind of inspired me back in the 90s to, and a little later, but it was kind of an editorial website. So they would post interesting articles with, hold on, hyperlinks. There were hyperlinks in the article. And so it was just one of those things that at the time it helped me understand the power of the web. It was something where you could sit down on a computer, write something, and publish it for the whole world to see. And that's something that I still hold on to and kind of appreciate. So
that is, and it really, that is a tremendous website. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. If you're listening to this at home, and to be honest, even if you're on your mobile, for a site that was built in 1995 and lasted until, it seems the last articles were being published in 2001.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It looks like it's going to work on your mobile just fine.
Because exactly.
That's how the web works before we started playing with it.
Yep.
Definitely, everyone go and check that out. It is safe for work. I promise you.
Is it actually still up there? I assumed that it was just kind of, I mean, I'm not going to,
Yeah. See, I typed it in. You should type it in as well. Type in suck.com and make sure. It is. It's still, there's some things that says the 4th of June 2001 was, are you too old for sex? Time for some gardening.
Yes. But
it's not all about that. It's not all about that. It's quite a cool little site. Go and check that out.
Yeah, check out the earlier ones too, especially the ones in the 90s versus the 2001. That's the gold right there.
So. Daily essays start in 1995.
There you go.
Let's have a look. It goes way back. So I think it's like the 28th of August, 1995, it kicks off. So this has got to be one of the older websites getting around.
Yep.
And probably the domain name worth the most money doing the least shit isn't on domainnamesales.com.
That's right.
Thank you very much for your time this evening, Jeremy. If people want to get in touch and follow you on Twitter and check out the work that they're doing, where do they sort of find out where you're at?
Yep. So my Twitter handle is at Jeremias, which is Spanish for Jeremy, so Jeremias. You can also kind of connect with me. I got my website, jeremyosborne.com, is also another place. And that's the way to do it. Of course, you can also go onto Gymnasium and take a class and post in the forum. And, I stop by there almost every day as well. So that's another place too. And maybe you can learn something.
Awesome. And what we'll do is we'll put a transcript up of this once it gets transcribed, and I'll put some links in the show notes as well to some of the sites that we've talked about, some of the courses that Jeremy's talked about, and some of the books that he's written as well. But again, thank you very much for joining. It's been really good to hear all the stuff that you've been working on, and I think online education on the web is sort of where it's at. And I think you're in a good place and doing some really good things.
Well, thanks so much. And I appreciate you bringing me on. And this was great. It was a lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for downloading. Please rate up the podcast in whatever pod listening device that you're using. iTunes is often the best for rating. We'll be back next week with another guest. And until then, thanks for downloading. See you, everyone.